Funding for a popular scholarship program is the target of a lot of Florida lawmakers, but why? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Bright Futures is a program that has helped Florida students for decades get a quality higher education. But some lawmakers want to change the rules and decide who qualifies for the scholarship. Also, students owe millions of dollars in loans to for-profit colleges in Florida. A new report in the New York Times shows these institutions continue to operate with little oversight, and students have few options with those degrees. Finally, the University of Miami and Broward schools have been victims of cyber attacks. Can we protect our students' information from hackers? This program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for joining us. Florida lawmakers have backed down from a controversial plan to reduce Bright Futures scholarships for students whose majors don't directly lead to employment. But that doesn't mean the scholarship is safe from pandemic-induced budget cuts. Florida has a history of increasing the requirements to receive Bright Futures when there's a budget shortfall, and it's impacting Black and Latino students the most. The program has provided an affordable education for Florida's residents over the past two decades, if they meet certain academic requirements. Well, joining us now is WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bakeman. She's also the editor and project manager of Class of COVID-19, which looks into how the pandemic has impacted Florida's most vulnerable students. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Luis.
So for our listeners who may not be familiar, remind us again what the Bright Futures program is, how it works.
Right. So Bright Futures is a state-funded, merit-based scholarship program that was created in 1997 with the intent of trying to keep Florida's best high school students in Florida for college. So basically, it covers up to 100% of tuition and fees at public colleges and universities in Florida. There are two different tiers of it. The top tier, which is called the Academic Scholars, gets that 100% of tuition and fees plus $300 stipend each semester to cover textbooks. The second tier, which has slightly less difficult eligibility requirements, it's called the Medallion Scholar, that covers 75% of tuition and fees. And again, this is based on public college tuition. However, if you qualify for Bright Futures and you want to go to a private college, you can still get the scholarship, but you just take the money to your private college, and obviously it doesn't cover 75 or 100% of private college tuition.
Right, right. Well, so lawmakers recently, they retreated from this controversial plan that would have reduced the scholarship amounts for students who choose majors that they say don't directly, quote, directly lead to employment. What majors and careers are they talking about?
Well, this might sound familiar to some of our listeners, Luis, because this kind of rhetoric around college majors that aren't tied to the economy or to the job market has been going on for years. And back in 2011, then Governor Rick Scott actually kind of got himself into a little bit of trouble when he made a comment like, we don't need more anthropology majors in Florida. This year, the lawmakers that have been working on this plan, there was a bill going through the legislature that's now been amended that would have said, okay, if you end up on this list of majors that state higher education officials will create that says, okay, your major doesn't lead to a job, then instead of paying for all of your tuition and fees, we're only going to pay a smaller percentage. In a way to encourage students to choose majors that state lawmakers or higher education officials believe do lead to jobs. But some educators have pointed out the flawed thinking in that. For example, we had a Florida Atlantic University President John Kelly on a while back, about a month ago, and he was saying, you know, human resources is a very in-demand field right now. And if you want to understand what makes people satisfied with their work, what makes them want to stay with a company, that might be a good job for a psychologist or even an anthropologist, Right. So he was making the point that what someone coming from a point of view of a state lawmaker or even higher education officials in Florida, many of whom are really based in the business sector, might not understand that just because this degree doesn't sound like it's going to lead to a job doesn't mean that it actually won't.
Yeah. By the way, do we know if the program, if Bright Futures, is that a big cost for the state budget?
So last year it was about $650 million. That sounds like a big amount of money, but right now they're debating what could be a $90 billion state budget. So it's not a huge cost. Also, when we say state funded, in the context of Bright Futures is funded by the Florida Lottery. And so what is happening now in the legislature is while the Senator Dennis Baxley, who's the one who proposed that plan that would have said, okay, you get less money if we don't think your major will lead to a job. They took that part out of the bill. But what's still in the bill is a change to how Bright Futures is funded. So instead of it being funded with the lottery, it would be funded based on basically however much money lawmakers decided to allocate toward it during each budget cycle. And that is a big difference because the way things work right now, if you qualify, if you meet the qualifications, you're going to get Bright Futures. There's no like, oh, there wasn't enough money this year, you know, but if they change it, it will be prorated, so to speak. So they'll say, this is the amount of money we're going to spend on Bright Futures this year. And then if more students qualify for Bright Futures, then they can afford to pay at the 75% rate or the 100% rate, then they'll just scale back those percentages. So the same number of students would get it, but they wouldn't get as much money.
So lawmakers have slashed Bright Futures in the past during difficult budget cycles. Typically, which students have been impacted the most when they do that?
What we've seen is that Black and Latino students, as well as low-income students, suffer the most when that has happened. So this year, what they're doing is a little bit different in terms of how they're looking at cutting Bright Futures. Like I explained, you know, they're looking at, okay, saying this is how much money each year will go to Bright Futures. And then however many students, you know, qualify will get it, you know, and it may not be that 75% of tuition and fees or 100% of tuition and fees if there's not enough money to support that. In the past, they did something a little different, which was instead of changing the amount of money that's going into Bright Futures, they changed the eligibility requirements. So currently you have three eligibility requirements if you're a high school student that you have to meet to qualify for Bright Futures. You have to have a certain GPA, you have to have a certain SAT or ACT score, and you have to have a certain number of volunteer hours. And so those eligibility requirements are different. They're higher for that highest level, which covers 100% of tuition and fees, and then slightly lower for the second level. And so in the past, what they've done is make it a higher SAT or ACT score, make it a higher GPA, make it a higher number of volunteer. Exactly. So if you make it harder to get, then fewer students will qualify. And lawmakers will say that this has nothing to do with race, but the data are the data. When you look at what happened in the past when these changes were put into place, for example, in the changes that the legislature put into place after the Great Recession took full force for the class of 2014. And in 2016, the Sun Sentinel reported that if you looked over from 2012 to 2016, the number of white students receiving a Bright Futures scholarship dropped by about 50%. So there were a lot fewer white students that were eligible for Bright Futures when they changed the requirements. But it was disproportionately impacting Black and Latino students. So the number of Black students who qualified dropped by 3/4, and the number of Hispanic students dropped by 2/3.
There's an argument right now for increasing the investment in college financial aid based on need, not merit. Who's making that argument?
So several lawmakers, one in particular is local to us, Senator Chevron Jones, who is a Democrat from West Park in Broward County. He, a couple of years ago when he was in the state house, proposed a bill for a new scholarship called the Sunshine Scholarship, which is based on need. And it essentially is what's called a last dollar scholarship. And what that means is the state pays the last dollar after a student applies whatever other financial aid they might get. So if you're a student who qualifies for a federal Pell Grant, you'd apply that toward your tuition and fees. If you got Bright Futures, you'd apply that toward your tuition and fees. And then at the end of the day, whatever was left, say it's $2,000, the state would cover that $2,000. So you essentially have free tuition. And this is something that a bunch of states have done, including New York and Tennessee. So Senator Jones is saying we should do something like that instead of something like Bright Futures. And part of why he's arguing that, especially at a time when we're talking about inequity, racial inequity, socioeconomic inequity, which we know has really been exacerbated by the pandemic, you look at these indicators like grade point averages and SAT scores, and you find that those indicators are really affected by the prejudices that are baked right into our public school system. And so if you're a student of color or a low-income student and you go to a school that has less funding or less experienced teachers, or you have less opportunities to take advanced coursework, which all of those things are true across the board, then of course you may not be able to get the same SAT score. So it's really, it goes to some deeper inequities that need to be fixed in order for Bright Futures to really be a fair situation.
Right.
Also, undocumented students do not have access to state financial aid, which was something that a different lawmaker, Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith, a Democrat from Orlando, was trying to change. He had submitted a bill that would allow undocumented students who went to high school in Florida to get access to not only Bright Futures, but any state financial aid programs.
Right.
But those proposals have not really gained traction.
Again, talking with WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bakeman, this conversation, part of the class of COVID-19, looking at how the pandemic has affected education in Florida. For that project, Jessica has reported on how the Florida legislature may make changes to Bright Futures. And again, you could always go to classofcovid.org for more information on her research. What's happening right now in the legislature on this debate? Where's this going?
So we should get an answer to where it's going in the next few weeks. We're at the point in the legislative process where the state House of Representatives and the state Senate have each put forward their individual budget proposals. We've had the governor's budget proposal for a while. And so from this point forward, they're working on, negotiating over the differences in their budgets. You know, they'll make some compromises based on their different priorities. And so far, the idea of cutting Bright Futures or spending less money on Bright Futures is really only a priority in the Senate. Like I mentioned, Senator Dennis Baxley, a Republican from Ocala, he's the one who has been proposing these changes to Bright Futures. However, there's no companion bill or identical bill in the House. And also the governor has said, you know, that he's fully funded Bright Futures in his budget and that he thinks that Bright Futures is kind of like a promise that the state makes to students. If you work hard, if you get these grades, you know, you can get this college scholarship. So it's not clear yet whether this will end up happening as far as these cuts, but I think kind of more in the weeds or more in depth, it goes back to this conversation we were having about the Florida lottery. Now, I'm sure you've seen the Florida lottery commercials that say, like, over the years, we've raised billions of dollars for education. So the lottery money is specifically earmarked toward education. And Bright Futures has been a huge chunk of that for a long time. Our colleagues at the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau reported that there's about $2.2 billion available in this trust fund that comes from the lottery. $1.9 billion of that is from the lottery. And I'll remind you that Bright Futures cost about $650 million last year. So currently, less than half of the lottery funding that is available is going toward Bright Futures, which you could argue means there's plenty of money in that trust fund to fully fund Bright Futures and even expand eligibility requirements for Bright Futures. But I think what the legislature is seeing here is an opportunity to take some of that lottery funding and put it toward other educational costs, which means, you know, they could continue some of their other priorities, like not raising property taxes on individuals and businesses, which that money goes to education as well.
Lawmakers finding money in other places. We've heard that story. Let me finish with this. Florida's public higher education system has been lauded by many nationwide for its affordability and its quality. But how significant is Bright Futures in that success?
I think it is significant. I mean, Bright Futures really, while it has been controversial over the years for some of the reasons we've discussed, it is really seen by a lot of people as like the shining star of higher education policy in Florida, an example that other states should emulate. However, I think the lauding nationwide over affordability has more to do with the fact that colleges and universities have not increased tuition in a decade or more in Florida. And so while other states have continued to raise tuition, Florida's tuition has remained flat, which just means that Florida ends up looking pretty good compared to the rest of the country in terms of public college and university tuition. Now, that is another conversation that we'll be having this session, because legislative leaders have suggested that increasing tuition, particularly at public universities, is something that they may have to look into. Because when you don't increase tuition, but the costs go up, which they do because of inflation, because of costs in health insurance for employees and all these other, you know, utilities, things that change over time for what it costs to run a university. If the student's contribution, which is the tuition, stays the same, and then the costs are going up, then the rest of that money has to come from somewhere. And it generally is coming from, you know, state funding, so taxpayers.
And that is, as the legislature continues, we will continue to watch that as well. WLRN's education reporter, Jessica Bakeman. Again, check out classofcovid.org for more stories like this one. Jessica, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lewis.
Well, still to come, how for-profit colleges are putting Florida students into debt and providing few job prospects. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. For-profit colleges have long been operating in the Sunshine State, often putting students into debt they can't get out of while providing a degree that isn't worth that much. These institutions offer their own loans, oftentimes at high interest rates, and can hold that debt over the student and even withhold diplomas and certifications until it's paid off. There are 45 for-profit colleges across the state of Florida, places like Full Sail University, Florida National University, and Florida Career College. An investigation by the Hechinger Report in partnership with the New York Times found that these institutions continue to operate with little oversight. Sarah Batramovich is the senior editor for investigations, and Meredith Kolodner is a senior investigative reporter with the Hechinger Report, and they join us now. Sarah, Meredith, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
You know, Sarah, the for-profit colleges, this story is not new. Stories like this of defrauding students for years is not new, but only a couple of schools have been shut down after investigations. Why is this still a story?
So it's still a story for many reasons. Particularly, as you mentioned, these schools continue to operate. There isn't a lot of oversight at the federal and state level, often into kind of the details of how they operate, which can allow schools to get away with things that students allege are very harmful. And it's a particular focus for us right now is because you often see for-profit colleges sort of get this boost of enrollment during an economic downturn that happened in 2008. And obviously we're seeing a lot of economic issues across the country right now with COVID, and we are seeing for-profit enrollment start to go up again. So a lot of people who have been sort of warning for years that these colleges have not disappeared, that they are still there, are really concerned to see what's going to happen moving forward, given the fact that more students may be turning to them.
Yeah. Meredith, remind us of how these institutions work. What's the difference between a regular college or a community college and one of these for-profit institutions?
Well, the for-profit colleges tend to charge more, and they tend to have very aggressive advertising and marketing campaigns. So they specifically go after students and often low-income students, and they target them in order to get them to enroll. But also, the low-income students come with a certain amount of federal aid. And so some people would accuse these for-profit colleges of trying to get that federal financial aid. Some of the colleges have low graduation rates. They are more expensive and often have higher debt loads when the students graduate.
Is there a difference, though, in the way they sell themselves so that you could tell the difference?
That is part of the problem. They advertise more aggressively, but they don't say we're a for-profit college. There are no public warnings saying, you won't see on their website, you know, we cost more than your local community college.
Right.
You can find the tuition and the average debt that students graduate from, but they're on federal websites, and they a lot of students wouldn't necessarily know how to find them.
Yeah, and because I'm wondering, what can students do in terms of research to understand the legitimacy of these programs? Is that easy to find?
So, as Meredith mentioned, you can find this information on federal websites. College Scorecard, it's probably the easiest one to navigate and has some of it. There are also some rules about disclosures that these institutions have to provide to their students. They were somewhat dialed back under Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. And also, we've spoken with many advocates who kind of make the point that just having a disclosure website doesn't mean a student is going to find it. Even if you give them a disclosure in person, when they're enrolling, they're getting a stack of paperwork. And we hear very often from students that the enrollment process at some of these schools can be really rushed, that they can be, you know, just kind of told, no, you don't have to like worry about that. You know, we have to give these to you, but we promise you're going to get a really great job. It's fine. And students can be really encouraged to not scrutinize what they're being given.
And that's an interesting point I'll get to in a little bit about how the guarantees they make. But for this story in the New York Times, you spoke with Kashia Campbell, a graduate from Florida Career College. Sarah, what was her experience like getting a degree or trying to get a degree in patient care?
Well, I'll actually defer to Meredith on that question because she is the one that spent a lot of time getting to know Kashia and her story. So I'll let her answer.
Yeah, Meredith, what was that experience like for her? Because, I mean, it just sounded like a horrible roller coaster trying to get information.
That's right. I mean, she signed up to become a patient care technician, and she graduated and got really top grades. So she was in a perfect position to get one of those jobs. And she was promised when she enrolled, you know, this is the type of job you can get. You can make decent money. When she went to take the certification exam, which you need in order to sort of be a certified patient care technician, she was told that she wasn't even allowed to take the exam. It's not that she failed it. She wasn't allowed to take it because the college was not releasing her transcript because she still owed money on this loan that came directly from the college. And that's sort of the difference. This isn't your traditional federal loan. With the federal loan, you can begin paying back your loan 6 months later. They don't withhold your transcript. But in this case, she couldn't, because she still owed a bunch of this money, she couldn't get her certification. So she ended up with a job that she really might have been able to get had she never gone to school in the first place. So she ended up really regretting ever having gone. And, you know, now she's unemployed and looking for work outside of the healthcare.
So she never got the certification.
That's right. Even though she, given her grades, she really probably could have passed it. She just wasn't allowed to because she still owed money.
Do you see that? Because, again, she was at Florida Career College. Do you see that across the board, that they can keep you from taking the final exam and getting your diploma or your certificate until you pay back the loan?
Unfortunately, that is not uncommon. It's called transcript withholding, and probably some of your listeners will have experienced it. It doesn't happen with the federal loans, but these loans that come directly from the college, there's not a lot of oversight. That's one of the things that's missing. Some states are talking about doing oversight, but so yes, they can do this, and it's not uncommon. We have heard about it in other states, but it, you know, as Kashia says, it really is a catch-22, because had she gotten the certification, perhaps she could have begun to pay back that loan more quickly, because she could have gotten a better paying job.
Now she has that debt. She has the debt, and she has no certification. Sarah, I'm hearing this: promises, guarantees, what these schools will help you get so that you can go out there and get a great job. Legally, can an institution make a guarantee or promise of employment right after finishing?
No, legally they can't. And they'll, again, in the disclosures and disclaimers and this pile of paperwork that they give, they'll make that clear. But again, from Meredith and I have reported on a lot of different for-profit institutions over the years, and that's something that we hear a lot, is sort of this informal, never documented, so it's hard to prove after the fact, but these conversations that happen when a student is touring a school, often when they go to tour a school, they're heavily encouraged to sign up that day, not go home and think about it. It's expedited. The people who work there, you know, try to make it as easy as possible for them. And they'll be told, you know, you can expect to get a job earning this much an hour, or, you know, all of our graduates get jobs. And these are some statistics that schools are supposed to track. And again, like, disclose if students know where to look for it. But we find that often what is tracked does not match up with what students tell us that they were told.
Again, talking with Sarah Batromovich, Senior Editor for Investigations, and Meredith Kolodner, Senior Investigative Reporter with the Hechinger Report. Again, looking at this investigation into loans offered by for-profit schools like Florida Career College, and in many cases, just like one of the stories that they were looking into, one student falling into debt, not even being able to take their finals, get a certification, and go out and find a good job, and then leaving with a lot of debt. Again, these schools not regulated, not a lot of oversight into them. And as we're hearing, they're pushing students into these loans. I want to talk about finances. Sarah, can students get federal loans to get to these schools, or do you have to get the loan that they offer?
So they can get federal loans. And that's actually a really important piece of this, is the schools want them to get federal loans. So there is a rule that a for-profit college can't get any more than 90% of their revenue from the federal financial aid. So that's loans and grants. The other 10% has to come from somewhere else. So what we found is these institutional loans that places like Florida Career College offer help them bridge that gap, get that 10%, while still letting them bring in, you know, millions and millions in federal financial aid. So it's having the students take out both types of loans is actually sort of baked into the business model of many of these schools.
So it's a 90-10 rule. At least 10% has to, or I should say, yeah, 10% was mm-hmm. it has to come from their own money that they're giving out, right?
Well, it can come from students paying directly out of pocket, from private loans, from them paying back institutional loans. It just can't be federal money. So the idea is that these schools try to get a huge portion of their revenue from that federal money and then use these loans and other mechanisms to cover the rest.
Because how much of the money that they give out do they actually recoup?
So this was a really hard question to answer because no one is actually making them report this, but we went through a lot of audits that they do have to submit to the federal government. And what we found was actually somewhat surprising to us is these schools often seem to plan to write off a lot of this money, whether they sell it to a debt collector or just say, we're never going to see it. So for instance, International Education Corporation, which owns Florida Career College, and the most recent audit that we were able to get for them, they were only expecting to get about 40% of these loan payments back, or they're expecting 40% wouldn't be paid back, excuse me. And they were only expecting to get 60% back. And they make a few million selling the unpaid loans off to debt collectors, so they get some more in that way. But they sort of acknowledged in some of their paperwork that they didn't expect students to actually be able to pay this back.
And they're okay with that because they know that if they meet that rule, then they can get, they qualify for that for the federal dollars.
Exactly.
Do we have a sense if this is a problem that's more significant in Florida than any other state?
So the answer, again, comes down to oversight, and unfortunately is no, we don't. So as part of this project, I reached out to agencies in all 50 states asking them if they tracked this. I contacted three in Florida, and it was basically not something that any of them were looking at. And that was true in a lot of states. I didn't get many responses even saying, yes, schools have to tell us if they do this. So it's really hard to get a picture for how things vary at the state level when no one's really watching.
Is anybody, any state, or is there any conversation on the federal level to create some more oversight of these kind of institutions?
On the federal level, people are somewhat hopeful that the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, under the new Biden administration, may take a closer look at these types of programs. And there are some states working on different state laws that might require some amount of information reported or registering, but it's still somewhat sporadic.
Yeah. Meredith, I mean, we have stories like, you know, again, Kashia Campbell and the struggles that she went through. Do these programs work, though? I mean, do we know if there are students who do get their certificates and they go on to get good jobs?
There are certainly people who graduate from these schools who get their certificates, they get their degree, and they do go on to get jobs. So it's not that every single person, fails and ends up in bankruptcy or anything like that. But if you look at the campus that Kashia went to, you know, that it's 95% of those students used federal loans in some way. It cost $26,000 to go there. And the average debt, I believe, is in the $10,000 to $15,000 range. So even if you do graduate and you do get a job, you're still, you know, you're just still sitting with all this debt. And the thing about that debt is it doesn't even include these institutional loans. These loans are totally below the radar screen. They can, you know, they can make them pay them back immediately. The federal loans, you can wait 6 months after graduation to begin even paying. The interest rate is like 2.5 or 3%. Whereas these interest rates can go up to 19%. So no, these loans are much more. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I was just thinking about, I mean, the conversation I had just before I brought the two of you in was about, you know, higher education costs here in Florida and how, you know, higher ed in Florida, public colleges and universities, is relatively cheap when you look around the country. And I'm wondering what's so appealing about these schools that, you know, if you wanted to get a certificate, you could go to a community college and a fraction of the cost, maybe even less time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in some cases, like for Kashia, this school was right down the street. And so she went, they advertised a lot. She walked in, they said, come here, you can get a good job, you can do it in 9 months. And it just seemed convenient and easy. And she wasn't aware of a community college program, which she found out later would have just cost $1,000.
Yeah.
So if you think about the marketing budgets of the for-profit colleges versus community colleges, which are really financially strapped given the cuts that they've gotten from the states, some students just aren't aware that they could get a similar certification or degree for so much cheaper.
Yeah, it comes down to, hate to say it, but it just comes down to a little extra time and research. It's out there. The information is out there. Sometimes, as you said, hard to find, though, but I understand. Sarah Batramovich, again, Senior Editor for Investigations, Meredith Kaladner, Senior Investigative Reporter with the Hechinger Report. And you could read more about that on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Sarah, Meredith, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you for having us.
And again, you could always stay in touch with us on segments like this, because if you went to one of these colleges, we'd love to hear your story. Tell us what your experience was like. Join our Sundial Text Club and share your thoughts. It's really easy. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's just type the word hello to 786-677-0767. Well, still to come, we're going to talk with a cybersecurity expert about the recent ransomware attacks on schools in South Florida. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Hackers are getting more brazen and their ransom demands are growing. Recently, the University of Miami and the Broward County school systems were hacked, threatening the personal information belonging to patients, students, and teachers. These people use ransomware to hack in and then sometimes actually grab personal information. In the case of Broward schools, the hackers demanded $40 million to release back that information. Is there a way to stop these attacks, or are security professionals always just one step behind? Can parents and students trust these institutions to keep their information safe? Joining me now is Jorge Ortega, Director of Miami-Dade College's Cybersecurity School of the Americas. Jorge, great to have you back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So both of these cyber attacks were ransomware attacks, among the more common used by hackers. Explain how that works as a way of stealing information.
So the ransomware attack itself is normally not done to steal information. It's normally done to get financial resources from the organization that gets attacked. And what the ransomware attack normally does is encrypts your computer system. So if you're an organization and a ransomware attack infiltrates your system, what it normally does is it encrypts, starts encrypting the computers that the individuals use, and it also normally moves into the servers and encrypts that as well. So what ends up happening is you have your entire network is now encrypted, which essentially means you have no access to it. You don't have any access to your data or your systems, and you need to pay a ransom to get a decryption key, which is what would unlock that system.
Is it like saying somebody breaks into my house and they lock me out and now they want ransom to give me the key so I can get back into my own house?
Absolutely. And that key only exists. There's only one copy of that key and they have it. And there's no other way for you to get entry into your house. So you're basically stuck with two options, right? You just walk away and you leave the house as is, or you pay the ransom and you get the key back. So that's exactly what it's like. And that's what forces organizations to really make a tough decision. Do they have the data backups, and do they have the systems and the availability and the resources to rebuild their entire system? Because that's what they would have to do if they do not get the key back.
Yeah.
Or do they just want to pay what's being asked and get the key? Now, of course, if they pay, they're also assuming that they are going to get the key, which
there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee of that, because most of these, they want the ransom paid in cryptocurrency. But in the case of the University of Miami, the hack, it was of a file sharing software. I believe it's called Excellion. Does this mean that multiple institutions were impacted, because it wasn't just UM who used that?
It does seem that way. I mean, I believe there are other institutions that have said that they were impacted as well. And that brings up a really good point in terms of, you know, it's not only your infrastructure that could be affected by some of these attacks. A lot of the third-party vendors that an organization works with could be attacked, in which case it puts your users or your customers in danger. So, yes, normally these organizations, they may try to attack a third-party vendor that has information for many institutions or many organizations. And in that way, they basically are able to get more impact by just infiltrating one organization because it's a third party provider for many others.
Yeah, and we, by the way, we did reach out to the University of Miami for a response into this, and we received the following response as UM is investigating this cyber attack. This is just an excerpt. We're going to publish the full thing on WLRN.org later today, but this is what they said to us. The University of Miami is currently investigating a data security incident involving Excellion, a third-party provider of hosted file transfer services. As soon as we became aware of the incident, we took immediate action to investigate and contain it, including immediately disabling Excellion. We also retained leading cybersecurity experts to assist in the investigation. Our investigation into this incident is ongoing. We have begun notifying affected individuals by postal mail under applicable laws. So is it common for universities to work on these shared platforms?
I would say it is. I would say in today's environment, there is a lot of third-party services that are being procured by universities and schools and really all types of organizations, especially, you know, with the situation we've had with the pandemic, really accelerating organizations needing to digitally transform their operations. It is very costly and complicated and resource heavy to manage everything, you know, internally or on your own premises, so to speak. So there is definitely, you know, a benefit to using third-party providers that are experts in a certain area, using their applications and their systems to be able to give your users a better experience. But when you do that, you know, like anything else, you're entrusting your data and your customer experience, et cetera, to third-party providers. And, you know,
and something
just the way it can be.
Yeah, something interesting about this. I mean, normally universities and organizations have time to test the security platforms, but they may not have been able to in this case because of COVID. You know, everyone had to transition virtually almost immediately, right? Did that have an effect, do you think?
I think it did. I think you hear really across all industries about how, as I mentioned, digital transformation had to be accelerated, you know, incredibly fast. So while organizations and schools being no different were moving to a more digital sort of experience, there was a need to immediately move much quicker. And so, yes, you may have not have done some of the security or even operational QA that you would normally do.
Yeah.
Because you just had to get up and running as soon as possible.
What can you tell me about how Miami-Dade College protects its data?
So, like any organization, you know, we have a very robust, dedicated technology team with security professionals as part of that team that are fully vigilant in terms of data security, you know, making sure all the systems and, as I mentioned, all the different services that are being applied, all the digital access, et cetera, that everything is as protected as possible, that all the systems are updated, because that's another area that also you see a lot of issues with organizations not updating their systems on a regular basis for different reasons. And so things like that is something that Miami-Dade College does and ensures that the security is at a very high level for everyone that uses the system.
Again, talking with Jorge Ortega, director of Miami-Dade College's Cybersecurity School of the Americas, the University of Miami and Broward County Public Schools both targeted in ransomware attacks. We've included further information online on those stories. So in the case of Broward County Schools, hackers demanded $40 million in cryptocurrency. What is the process for schools to determine whether their information has been compromised, you know, and even consider maybe paying? I mean, how do you know?
So that, you know, the Broward County one is that one is much more what you see in the traditional ransomware attack, where they did get all their servers encrypted, apparently from what's been made public. And obviously the threat is from the perspective of the ransomware attackers. They're saying, you know, we have all this information. I think they said they have over 1 terabyte of information, and we're going to post it online. And so it adds the fear factor that all of this information is all of a sudden going to be made public. And it kind of increases the likelihood that an organization will want to pay to not let that happen.
But how do we know they're not bluffing?
The way you would know that, the way is you simply ask them. And normally what they would do is they would send you some information to prove that they have it. And then at that point, if they're able to prove that they have some of the information, then you can assume possibly that they have everything they're saying they have. Yeah. But there's no other way to really know except for them, I guess, proving it to you. Right.
Yeah. And by the way, we also reached out to Broward Schools and they sent us a response. Again, we'll publish the entire thing online, but this is just a part of it. They actually sent out, they had two statements. This is the second one, and it came out March 31st. Broward County Public Schools is committed to protecting the data on its systems. Unfortunately, all organizations face increasingly sophisticated and malicious threats to cybersecurity. To help further protect against these types of incidents, the district has taken steps to enhance the security of its systems, including additional administrative, technical, and physical safeguards. BCPS is continuing to work with cybersecurity experts to investigate the incident and remediate affected systems. Efforts to restore all the systems are underway and progressing well, and we have no intention of paying a ransom. I found that very interesting. How are you approaching this field now of cybersecurity with your students, considering we're seeing these attacks are just, again, they're growing in number?
Yeah. So what we keep telling our students is exactly that is, I don't want to say luckily because you don't want this unfortunate incident to happen to anyone, but it's not hard to find that these attacks are prevalent. And so what we tell the students is as this society continues to move towards, a digital platform in all facts of life in terms of Internet of Things and things of that nature where all your devices will be connected, security has to be at the forefront of that. Because if you have all your securities, all your appliances and all your devices connected and security is not part of that, then the implications could be catastrophic. And so What we tell our students is, this is a field that's just going to continue to grow.
That's interesting. You see, it continue to grow, but here's the thing. Like, let's say I graduate from your program. Look, big companies will probably pay very hefty money for me to come in and protect their systems compared to, like, if I worked in the public sector, like at a school district. You know, I mean, how do you convince a student, to go work in a public school system when they could go work at a Google-sized company for a lot more money doing the same thing?
Right. Right. No, I mean, and that's the challenge. That's going to be a challenge in a lot of different positions. I think one of the things that smaller organizations are looking at is they're outsourcing some of their security. So what they're doing is they are taking some of that security, some of their security needs and giving it to experts that handle multiple organizations. So students can go work for those type of organizations. But I'll tell you what's great about, and I tell this to students all the time, is what's great about cybersecurity is that they can work in any industry. So no matter what your calling is, for some it might be the public sector, for some it might be law enforcement, for some, like you mentioned, it might be, the big tech companies. Cybersecurity spans across all industries. So
exactly.
A student has the opportunity to say, if I want to do cyber, but I still want to work in the non-for-profit sector, they can do that, And so it's a great way to mesh what they want to do, with their profession, also with something that's an incredibly high demand.
And briefly, Jorge, is it really come down to a lot of times? Does it come down to somebody opened up an email they shouldn't have? That's why we have some of these problems?
100%. I would say, depending on what the statistics you look at, but it's always the very high likelihood that it is a user action, such as what you just mentioned, a phishing email, or they went to a site and they entered their credentials. So one of the things that we always recommend organizations to do is just simply security awareness training for their members of their organization. If you get an email, and these emails are constructed in a way that make you want to take the action that they're asking you to take. Right?
Don't open most of your emails, please, if you don't know where it's coming from. Jorge Ortega, director of Miami-Dade College's Cybersecurity School of the Americas, thank you so much for the insight. Really good information. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right. Again, please don't open up those emails. You don't know where they're coming from. That's our program for this Tuesday, April 6th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, what does the future of development look like in South Florida? A new project led by developer Tony Cho is creating environmentally sustainable and affordable new homes, working with leaders across the globe. We're going to learn about the future of cities. Plus, April is the O Miami Poetry Festival. There are tons of events happening across the region, including a letter writing campaign between students in Puerto Rico and Miami. You can head to WLRN.org, by the way, for more about O Miami and zip codes, an ode to your zip code, because we do that every year, so take part. Again, that coming up tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thank you so much for listening. This program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Please, as always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.